Welcome to this week's episode of Until Green Card Do Us Part, a weekly show where we address the issues that immigration-based marriages made a few feet short of heaven create for American citizens and their families. I'm your host, John Sampson, CEO of CSI Consulting. This week, we have a little something different in store for you. Emily is back, but not as a guest, but rather as a co-host. So let's get right to it. So Emily, welcome back. And for those of you who are listening, we have an announcement to make. Emily is not appearing this week as a guest. From this point forward, Emily has agreed to be a co-host of the show. So you'll be hearing from the both of us on a weekly basis for the foreseeable future, if not longer. So Emily, welcome to the show as a co-host. Yes.
Thank you. I'm hooked.
I'm
hooked. It's such a great outlet. I'm actually really enjoying geeking out on this. And I've said before, it's super cathartic for me to get my story out. So thank you for asking me. And I'm looking forward to having some fun figuring out what to do and even sometimes debating with you.
Okay, that works. So this week, what we're going to do is we're going to pick up where we left off last week with the Violence Against Women Act. However, we're going to dive into a GAO report, a Government Accountability Office report, that was sent to Senator Lindsey Graham in 2019. So this is relatively recent, and it's 2 years ago. And the statistics in this are troubling. And Emily, you've done the research, so I'm going to turn it over to you to go for it.
You know, last time I kind of flippantly mentioned a statistic from a GAO report, and then I thought, yeah, we should actually really look at this GAO report because it's powerful and frightening and recent. So it's called Immigration Benefits, Additional Actions Needed to Address Fraud Risks in Program for Foreign Nationals, Victims of Domestic Abuse, otherwise known as the VAWA waiver, the Violence Against Women Act. Waiver program. Before I get into the stats, the one thing as I was looking back at this, it almost gave me chills, the timing, because it was published in September 2019. I was absolutely in the throes with my ex-immigrant spouse of the assault, figuring out what to do, filing police reports, filing restraining order against him. He violated the restraining order against me in September 2019. This was when the assistant DA made an administrative error and oopsie, dropped the charges by accident, even though there were four witnesses and it was recorded by dispatch. At the exact time I was going through this, this report was released. And I'd only just begun then to learn to my horror what my obligations could be under the I-864 and how my immigrant spouse could abuse that. So in looking at this, some of the things they mentioned is that the VAWA waivers during this study period, and this was only just like 2014 to 2018, this particular statistic, VAWA waivers or self-petitioned waivers were up by 75% in that short period of time. And within that, fraud reports were up over 300%. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that they highlighted in the fraud wasn't just like someone in my situation saying, hey, I've been defrauded. I actually have proof. I've been told. But it is, some of these things really hit me. They found, the GAO office found 845 instances of a single address being used. I think there was fraud in that. Like, hello, people, like second time an address was used, that should come up. Mm-hmm. So clearly their fraud detection is extremely poor, and I don't think that was even caught by USCIS until the GAO report was conducted. The other thing that really stuck out at me, not just the instances of fraud and the number of waivers being filed, but they actually don't track who the representatives are, who the attorneys are. So we can't see that, like, the one immigration office, attorney's office that only represents immigrants in the enforcement of the I-864 in Seattle, I would guess they'd be a really high percentage helping prepare these vowel waivers, but they have absolutely no information on that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that really troubled me is that even where there's fraud or where a self-petitioner has petitioned for this waiver, literally in this is word from word, word for word, it says adjudicators are prohibited from using information provided solely by the alleged abuser. In my case, I would be the alleged abuser. He made a cross allegation against me. And I was told this by an immigration attorney, one of several that I consulted with, who took my money for consultation, but wouldn't represent me, of course. They said, and they said that, but in other words, that the special unit in Vermont, the Vermont Service Center that processes all the vowel waivers, that they wouldn't look at anything I said. She said it in another way, that I would be a biased bidder
right.
X.
Well, that's and
but in reading this, I'm shocked. Because who else would submit the info besides me, besides the U.S. citizen who was accused? Who else would submit info? So there's really no opportunity or no desire or requirement to look at any other information than that provided by the self-petitioner.
Well, it's interesting because I'm reading that section of the report as you're saying it. And I'm involved in a couple of cases right now where the confidentiality provision of VAWA is being raised by either attorneys representing the immigrant spouse or the district attorney in Milwaukee in the human trafficking and rape case, where the district attorney is saying all this stuff is confidential. And in the next breath, she goes, but we don't even know if it, if it, U visa or T visa has been applied for. And my argument back is,
when how would they even know that then?
Well, if it's confidential, if you're raising confidentiality, yeah. You're admitting that the T visa or U visa has been applied for, because if it hasn't been applied for, there's nothing to claim is confidential because there's no application pending.
About.
Right. So, you know, the bottom line is in that particular case, the so-called investigation, because it wasn't an investigation. It was, I'll take the report, listen to the allegations, and then we'll go ahead and arrest the U.S. citizen solely on the information based by the immigrant and her son. And nobody took into consideration that she had a motive to remain in the United States and therefore file these fabricated charges because she came here as a fiancé. And once she comes in as a fiance, she has to marry the guy that petitioned for her, or the person, I should say, who petitioned for her, and only that person, and they have 90 days in which to do it. They can't get an extension, nor can they get a change of status to some other non-immigrant visa, say a student visa, tourist visa, what have you, temporary worker. It's mm-hmm. all or nothing. So when my client says after a very short period of time, he realizes that he had been scammed and he says, this isn't working out. You're not happy here. We're not happy. I will buy you a ticket to go home to the Philippines.
Yeah.
Okay.
I said the same thing to mine. I'm like, you're not happy here. You're clearly not interested in me.
Right.
I will buy you a ticket home. And
right.
the answer was no.
No, it's not a question of I'm not happy here. I'm not happy with you here. And mm-hmm. so they charged my guy with human trafficking. Now, I want you to understand the stupidity of all of this. Your average human trafficker does not give their victim a cell phone with which the victim can call law enforcement authorities, their family, lawyers, self-help groups, what have you. A bona fide human trafficker does not give the person who they're holding against their will the keys to, literally the keys to their jail cell, if you will, the, you know, the apartment, the house, whatever. They don't leave their victim unattended or unguarded for 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day. And they certainly don't say, oh, well, since things are not working out, I'm going to buy you a ticket to send home. Right. So.
And I bet they didn't take her passport and other identification or any means of getting.
No, they had
financial resources like a credit card or cash.
Right. So on top of that, this individual, this quote immigrant unquote victim, is being interviewed by Homeland Security Investigations by a special agent and a Milwaukee police detective. And in the interview is the immigrant's immigration attorney. So the DA is saying, well, this is not an immigration issue. Excuse me. Number one, you're charging my client with an immigration-based crime, to wit, human trafficking. B, the victim's immigration attorney is in the interview room, and when the kid is interviewed forensically, the immigration attorney is in the interview room. And you're telling me this isn't an immigration-based case? No. What you're saying is, we want her to stay in the country. We're charging your guy with human trafficking so she can apply for a T visa. We're going to invoke confidentiality, even though there are exceptions to the confidentiality provisions of the law, which allows for a court of competent jurisdiction to look at the file and to look at it in camera and bring attorneys into judges' chambers. I mean, there's all sorts of mechanisms there. And on top of it, the immigrant themselves, the so-called victim, can waive the confidentiality. But what happens is, and what's happened consistently, is that the immigrant rights organizations that are helping attorneys in these cases have said you make a blanket complaint or a blanket objection to the introduction of this stuff, citing a total prohibition of release. The prohibition of release of information does not involve local courts, judges, prosecutors, police officers or police departments or sheriff's offices. What the prohibition is aimed at are employees of the Department of Homeland Security.
The obstruction of justice.
Right.
Right.
Right. So it's only Department of Homeland Security people who are prohibited from releasing this information. And they're the ones that suffer the consequences if they incorrectly or inappropriately release the information. So, you know,
this is also, John, where everything gets conflated too, because the local courts have no idea any of this. They're totally out of their depth. My family court judge had no idea whether or not the I-864 should or shouldn't be applied. Would probably be like annulment. That means he could get deported. Well, let me not rule that way. So they're just totally out of their depth. So coming in and making all of these additional requirements and claims based on the confidentiality of someone who's filed a U or T visa, who then is also saying I can't disclose whether or not I filed it. I think people get really confused. Mm-hmm. Regardless of motivation, pro or anti-immigrant, pro or anti-legitimate victim of domestic violence, I think they get really, really confused when you bring in criminal law, restraining orders, actually civil law, family court, family issues, custody, civil law, and then immigration, federal law. And then you got an immigration attorney showing up who's knowledgeable in federal law, and everybody else is just like, oh, wait, what? We have to do. I'm not familiar with that. I don't want to make a mistake.
Right. So, I mean, it's and unfortunately, you know, the immigration law rivals the tax code in complexity. So,
yeah.
Speaking it from personal experience, when one goes to law school, it's not one of the required subjects that you are shown or given when you're your first year of law school or your second year of law school. It's an elective, and not too many people go into it. So it's the attorneys that are practicing family law, criminal law, are generally in the dark about how all this works. Now, it's beginning to show some light at the end of the tunnel, because more and more attorneys are being faced with these cases, because there are so many of them, that they're being forced to understand that there's an immigration component to a lot of these cases, whether it be a protection order, a criminal prosecution for sexual assault on one spouse by another, where the one spouse is an immigrant and one is not. Then you've got the whole issue of annulments versus divorces and the I-864, which we have beaten to death. You know, a lot of the family law attorneys just, you know, tell their clients, oh, you just need to withdraw the 864, not knowing that that's legally impossible, because once the immigrant gets their green card or is admit or gets their immigrant visa abroad, that 864 is graven in stone and it's not going anywhere. So, I mean, it's a slow process to educate everybody, but I have noticed that my caseload has gone through the roof. So this is not slowing down anytime soon.
You're in a unique position and responsibility to educate your clients, all that they are interacting with in the legal ecosystem, we'll call it, and then the general public.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know I'm, as I was talking about you with this with you, and for those who don't literally have the document open and can't turn to pages 34 and 35, like, I would love, John, for you to walk me through just how messed up the fraud detection system is for those who file for self-petitions, especially around VAWA.
Right.
Because it troubles me.
Well, let's start with the basic one. We'll go to page 33 of the report. Because as I'm scrolling,
okay.
I'm scrolling through it. I didn't write it. The GAO wrote it. When I read it, I highlighted in yellow some of the more relevant and prevalent issues that popped up. So let me just give you one ditty, and this one will toast your bagels, so to speak. for example, according to officials, USCIS does not check the validity of key identification information submitted by self-petitioners, and it does not analyze outcomes across characteristics of self-petitions. Practices or prior work indicates could strengthen USCIS's use of data analytics. In other words, and this is one of the biggest ones I've seen, is an immigrant comes in with children, your case, to coin a phrase, comes in with children, and USCIS does not request an overseas investigation to determine whether or not this immigrant was previously married in the home country and prior to coming to this country to marry a U.S. citizen, terminated the first marriage by some legal means, or the marriage was terminated as a result of the passing of their former spouse. So a lot of times what you see is they conceal the fact that they've been married, or they claim they've been divorced when there's no actual divorce on file in some courthouse or some government office. And they may even pony up a totally counterfeit one just to satisfy the documentary requirements. And then they get their green card.
Very easy to do.
Right?
Yep.
They get their green card. They then turn around, become a U.S. citizen, and it's somewhere along the process they jettison the U.S. citizen spouse that helped them get the green card, and then they marry or remarry their original spouse in the home country, and then the whole family is reunited. America, what a country. So, I mean...
Yep.
Basics, you know, just determine who these people really are. But it's, you know, when we get to the Department of Homeland Security's victims of immigration related crimes, or VOICE. You know, it's not widely known that this is out there, although when Trump was president, they bandied it out, you know, they heralded it, they, you know, the trumpets blew, the angels come down and say, all right, this is this new, if you're the victim of an immigrant who commits a crime against you.
I didn't know this existed myself. And so when I looked into it, I was actually kind of upset. Because mm-hmm. The mission is with honor and integrity. And by the way, what does VOICE stand for again? Voices of...
Victim of... Immigrant. Let me see if it says what it says here, because they just... It just says victims of immigration-related crimes, and that's how it is, but that's not the acronym. And I'm trying to see where in the report it may even say it. It just says VOICE.
Yeah. Well, I'll say that VOICE says the mission is with honor and integrity. We will support the victims of crimes committed by criminal aliens through access to information and resources. The objectives are to use a victim-centered approach, promote right. awareness of rights and services available to immigration victims, immigration crime victims, et cetera, et cetera. So I would certainly apply as or be the target audience for this, having been a victim of both assault
right.
and restraining order violations and marriage fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no idea that this existed. It did come into order by Trump's executive order in January 2017.
Mm-hmm.
My application for the K-1 and K-3 visas, and that was filed in December 2017. They came in November 2018, and we were married, and then filed for the adjustment of status to get contingent green card in December 2018. So this had already been around for 2 years. When my ex came into the country, he was provided all that information about the VAWA Act and his rights as an immigrant to not be abused, et cetera, et cetera. I was never notified about VOICE.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. I had to learn from the ground up about what my rights and resources were and make all sorts of, successes and failures in my process and learning very painfully how the criminal right. justice system worked. But why wasn't I advised of this? The other thing about this is, I've made no, it's no secret. I'm not a Trump supporter.
No.
I did learn that. Yeah, I know. But this is another one of those things, like the ICE protests in my city. I totally would have been one of the people out there, not knowing the full story, right?
Right.
So it turns out as soon as the VOICE hotline was launched, it was actually punked or trolled
mm-hmm.
and overwhelmed in the first day. The very first day was 16,000 calls. Because activists wanted to overwhelm it with fake reports.
Right.
And, that totally would have been up my alley. Like, I'm pro-immigrant. I want people to have opportunities. You know, if somebody's been here for 30 years and they're a productive member of society, but they're undocumented, right? However, now I'm on the other side of actually having been a victim of a crime perpetrated mm-hmm. against me, multiple crimes, by an immigrant. And I'm really upset that if I had actually tried to get through, my legitimate claim couldn't have been heard. Now, since then, I've learned, unfortunately, just how much more messed up this is, because you gave me statistics about the calls to VOICE.
Right.
And how many were immigration marriage fraud reports and how many actually got
right.
then reported back to the ICE.
So let me give you
hotline.
So let's give the listeners all that. But before I go there, I can now tell you what VOICE stands for. It's the victims.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, victims of immigration crime engagement.
There we go.
I don't know who comes up with these acronyms, but that one's
a
mouthful.
You got to force it in there to make the acronym work, right?
So, data collection by the VOICE office from hotline calls show that in fiscal year 2018. This is straight out of GAO
after the
report.
Trolling occurred.
A total
right.
of
after the trolling occurred, these are legitimate calls now, right?
Right, right. A total of 1,543 calls were made to the VOICE office. Now, before I go any further, one of the intents of VOICE was not so much marriage fraud or false allegations of domestic violence, but rather I'm a U.S. citizen walking down the street and I get held up by an illegal alien who shoves a gun in my face, which is a violation of federal gun control laws, by the way, and he robs me, and I report it to the police. The police arrest this guy. They go through the whole nine yards, and then when the guy goes to jail and he finally either finishes his sentence or he bonds out, nobody bothers to call immigration, okay? This office sprung out of the sanctuary movement throughout the country. Okay, so the intent wasn't so much for marriage. Yeah. It wasn't so much for victims of marriage fraud or visa fraud or false allegations of domestic violence. It's if, you know, a family member is killed by an alien who is a drunk driver and they need some sort of assistance. That's what this is for. But it has morphed partially into a reporting mechanism for people such as yourself saying, I'm a victim of immigration crime. It's called fraud. And so let's get into the stats. So 1,543 calls were made to voice. Of those 1,543 calls, a whopping 130, or 8%, were from self-identified victims of marriage-related fraud requesting assistance. Voice officials indicated that they would consider VAWA self-petition fraud as a subset of marriage fraud. However, self-petition fraud is not separately identifiable in their data. Of those 130 calls, the office referred 78 of them to ICE's Homeland Security Investigations, or HSI, tip line. For example, in one case from fiscal year 2018, a caller claimed that his or her spouse married the caller for immigration purposes and attempted to falsely press criminal domestic or violence charges against the caller as a means of obtaining immigration status. The office offered the caller local victim services and referred the caller to both USCIS and the ICE HSI tip line. Now, what would have been really interesting to see is if the GAO took it to the next level and followed that case to see what happened to it at the end. They didn't.
I'm going to make a what we call a WAG, a wild.
A wild derriere.
A WAG.
A WDG.
Nothing happened.
Yeah.
You know why? Because, USCIS and ICE tip lines, it's the same information. It's got the forms are the same. They got to go to the same place.
Mm-hmm.
But I filed one. And three other people filed one against my ex because we're all like, this is clearly what he's doing. He even said he was doing it, but it was verbal, so I can't prove that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's four of us that filed. Suspicion of marriage fraud. Gave as much information as we had at the time. Actually didn't know where he was living. He's concealing his whereabouts. And none of us heard a peep. Then in looking a little deeper, finding out that there's not a whole lot of incentive for these tips to be followed up upon, especially as he's here legally.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the priorities are like illegal aliens, those that have committed federal offenses, those that have committed national security concerns. Now, I still think that this marriage fraud has a potential for being, somebody's unethical enough to do this, and then they likely have, as in my case, multiple criminal charges against them, all of which were dropped by my lovely DA.
Right.
But I know you have other cases where there are national security concerns, because this is a really easy way to get in and commit fraud, which is what the GAO report is highlighting.
Well, it's odd. I have a case where the guy married a woman from the Philippines. She bails out, leaves him high and dry, and I conducted a background investigation to try and locate her. Well, I located her. She is now living on post at Fort Dix, New Jersey, at the U.S. Army Induction Center there, and living with what appears to be a soldier. Now, whether they got married, didn't get married, or she has a dependent ID card or not, I don't know. But what I told my client is I will be contacting Criminal Investigation Division at Fort Dix and say, hi, this individual here is, you know, she's living on your post. There's some question as to the legitimacy of how she got her status in the United States. And she's living with one of your soldiers. And granted, Fort Dix is not a high security base. It is a induction center and basic training facility for the Army. But there's the Lakehurst. This is all in one big happy family. There's the Lakehurst Naval Air Station and one other facility that's there. It's an Air Force base as well. So you've got all these shared services, armed forces that are using these facilities, and this individual is running around. There have been cases where a Russian female has married a retired lieutenant colonel from the Marine Corps when he was still on active duty, and she managed to somehow get plans and specifications on certain classified aircraft. And, you know, we're learning about this should not be something coming to somebody's surprise, because you have the recent revelation that Honeywell sold plans and information to the Chinese about the F-22 strike fighter. And I'm sitting here going, I don't understand how these people can sleep at night knowing that they're selling out the national security of this country. So I reported it, I reported that to NCIS. I haven't heard anything back. I don't know what's going on. There are two cases that I'd like to touch base on. Both of them are probably the most egregious cases and unusual cases of marriage fraud because of the shortness of time involved. I have one case where the woman comes in from India on a K-1 visa on February 10th, 2021, this year. She marries my client February 12th, 2021, 2 days later. On February 17th, 5 days after they get married, she and her son are in the police department alleging that she was assaulted. My client, who is a naturalized U.S. citizen of Indian ethnicity, and I mean East Asian Indian, not Native American. He works, albeit he's now on suspension without pay, but he works in the Indiana Department of Corrections. So.
And why is he on suspension without pay?
Well, that's something
because allegations have been made?
Yeah, allegations have been made. And his attorney and I had this discussion this morning. And I said, you know, my concern is if it comes up at trial, assuming we get that far, you know, what is your current status? Well, I've been suspended without pay. That would lead a reasonable person to conclude that at least the Department of Corrections believes he's guilty. Okay. So we've got that issue we're dealing with. Then the other case, which is equally interesting, is an individual in a suburb of Minneapolis marries a Brazilian who's here on a au pair visa. And they get married on the 3rd of October, go on a, quote, honeymoon, unquote. It's a driving honeymoon through three states, one of them being Colorado. And they get back on October 10th, and he drops her off at the family that she's still au pairing for. And that's the last time he ever sees her. In the meantime, 4 months later, she files a petition for a protection order claiming while they were in Colorado Springs, he sexually assaulted her. And
wait, they'd been married for a few days at this point.
Right.
And then he doesn't see her for several months.
Right. And she has totally she has totally abandoned him. And presumably has filed the protection order in order to file an I-360 self-petition under VAWA. Both of them have.
Uh-huh.
Because neither one of these clients have ever filed either the I-130 or the I-864, and there was no I-485 filed for them to adjust status. It was simply get married, and now that I'm married to a U.S. citizen, I'm now eligible to file for a VAWA-based immigration benefit. So
I see. So with or without the financial support of the U.S. citizens, they want to stay.
Right.
And so this is the fast track to be able to stay. And the second you file for the waiver, you cannot go into any removal proceedings. So you've got,
right,
you've definitely got a cushion of time, which could be years,
right,
just to be figured out.
And the interesting thing is there's no 864 requirement for an I-360 self-petition. You don't need one. So you don't need to deal with that issue. And then the other thing is you don't go through the conditional permanent residence. There's no purpose for that. And since you were married to a U.S.
Oh, so you just fast-tracked a permanent.
Correct. So you bypass the conditional permanent residence. You go fast-track the full-blown permanent residence. And then here's the gift that keeps on giving. Since you're the victim of spousal abuse by a U.S. citizen, you can file your application for naturalization at the 3-year mark as if you were still married to your U.S. citizen. You don't have to wait 5 years. So it is really the accelerated path to U.S. citizenship.
But they do have to give up the I-864.
But there's no...
So they give up the
opportunity to
financially
sue.
Financially supported.
Right.
And the opportunity to sue, but they get the fast track. They don't even have to mess around with this contingency for 2 years, pretending to be in love for any period of time. No suspected fraud from the what you might call it, when you file for permanent removal of the contingency, so you become a permanent resident based on marriage. So you come in and within days, you can be on fast track, the absolute fastest possible 3 years to be a permanent resident and get to stay in the United States if that's your goal.
Well, let's put it this way. The woman from India in Indiana, no pun intended, it just struck me. I'm going, the Indian woman from Indiana. Yeah, that's about right. Uh-huh. She's on a fast track within 7 days of her feet touching American soil.
Wow.
7 days. Incredible. 1 week.
That's incredible. And even though her, you know, husband of 7 days won't have the financial stress that I have of potentially paying my immigrant, as I call him now, my immigrant, $30,000 a year, potentially indefinitely, depending on whether or not he chooses to work and whether or not he chooses to report what he works. He still has financial implications because he's now on leave without pay and still has all these legal fees. And my God, they can rack up in the tens of thousands.
Right.
And
so
it feels like minutes. But
well, and I know you and I touched.
It's not a victimless crime.
No, it's not a victimless crime. But you and I touched upon this. And I don't know if we did it on the show or the pre-show interview where we were putting our notes together. But I have to find out, and I'm going to be seeing my tax person tomorrow. Yeah, I just had to file my taxes. I'm not happy.
No.
could have been worse, but I still have to write a check. So in any event, I still think that 864 affidavit of support proceeds should be taxable. So if you're paying your former immigrant spouse, the leech, $30,000 a year, I think he needs to report that as income. And I think not only that, but you should take it as a tax deduction. So
100%, absolutely.
So yeah. I think that's something I've got to talk to my tax guy tomorrow. Actually, I'm going to probably throw him a curveball because he doesn't know this is coming. But I do want to talk to him about it because I think that makes all the sense in the world that, A, you should take it as a tax exemption and he should report it as income. Because it is. Yeah. I mean, it's not like this is, you know, coming from the Treasury Department, you know, the free money that we got in the last two administrations, this one and the one previously. I'm not being partisan about this one. You know, it's like, let me make the analogy. When we went through all this COVID relief and people were getting expanded unemployment insurance benefits to the tune of an additional $600 a week. Thank you, Uncle Sam. What a lot of people didn't realize is unemployment insurance benefits are taxable income. So they're making $54,000 a year, and they're thinking, hey, this is cool. I think right about now, with the tax deadline date just having passed, the light bulbs are starting to light up saying, I have to pay taxes on this? Yeah, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Sorry to tell you.
That's what I was thinking. Is basically, I am the insurer of last resort for my ex-husband. I am his unemployment insurance. Well, and if you're unemployed, if I'm unemployed, I have to get that unemployment insurance benefit, I have to show proof that I'm actually trying to find work. He doesn't. I have to pay taxes on my unemployment insurance. He doesn't, and I'm basically his unemployment insurer of last resort. So I do think he should. You know, we actually tried to put this in an earlier settlement agreement because I was trying to settle from the beginning. We were both just racking up attorney fees. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, listen, like, if you're gonna sue me for this, at least try to work. And this was before I'd seen some of the court cases where there's no requirement to make reasonable efforts to work.
No, there aren't.
So I'm like, okay, let's at least pretend I'm like, you got to try to work. Send me some documentation of efforts to work. And then on a monthly basis, I'll make up the shortfall. Cause I also didn't know at that time that this is really meant to be annually. And he said, no, he said, I just want the money. And how does that show like what your motivation is? It's not really about making up your income cause you're struggling. You want a free ride off of me, off the US citizen.
Correct. Which, you know,
so that's a little bit of a digression because this is one area where the point is to fast track and still commit fraud. It still has a financial burden,
right?
And a lot of other repercussions, emotional, employment, all that, reputational. Mm-hmm. But they're giving up the I-864 for the benefit of the fastest of the fast tracks and towards permanent residency.
Right, I'm about to say something that's potentially controversial.
Go for it.
Okay. In the case of the guy who married the Brazilian out of Minnesota, they did not have an intimate relationship for the year and a half that they, quote, dated, unquote. And mm-hmm. they consummated their marriage on the evening of their marriage and had no other intimate relations for the remainder of the trip. Okay. And she then turns around and uses that consummation as the basis by which to allege sexual assault. Prostitution is defined as engaging in sexual intercourse in exchange for something of value. In this particular case, the something of value is permanent residence in the United States.
Yeah.
That's the way I'm looking at it. So it's highly inflammatory to say that, but the reality is that's what it is. Now you're right and you're 100% correct. Then in these two particular situations I've just outlined, the U.S. citizen escapes the financial liability that you have not escaped.
Long-term financial liability. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, what they're going through, however, is what I neglected to add to the conversation about the gentleman from Minnesota who married the Brazilian. He is in the middle of the application process to become a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So,
oh my God. Oh my
you know, God. When we had our intake call this morning, I told him, Eric, your priority right now is to get this protection order killed quickly.
Yeah.
Because I will guarantee you that if it is extended permanently, I don't care whether permanently means 2 years or whether it means forever and a day, you might as well kiss your opportunity to be a special agent with the FBI goodbye. It's gone. Given the fact that you won't be able to carry a firearm because of the Lautenberg Amendment and 18 U.S.C. 922G, which is the federal gun control laws as it relates to people who are ineligible to possess firearms or ammunition, a couple of those subsections deal with a person who's convicted of a crime involving domestic violence, whether it be a felony or a misdemeanor, it doesn't matter, or is the the restrained party of a permanent protection or restraining order. So they are no longer eligible.
If I was able to check the box for my ex and say, I do not want him to have access to a firearm, because I really thought he was going to kill me.
Right.
And they could have dropped that part, or they could have extended it. In Oregon, it's a year, and then you have to keep revisiting every year. Mm-hmm. Other states may be different. But, yeah, I, as the victim, could request that. And certainly if the Brazilian had requested that, then he's got to he's got to deal with that.
But, yeah, he does.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
And we're in the early stages with this case because his hearing isn't until July. So he's out.
Thank goodness he found you early, because I found you later in the stages and I was like absolutely like despondent.
Well,
and was able to get some hope from working with you.
Well, and here's the interesting thing. I got a call from an attorney last week, one of the preeminent criminal defense attorneys here in Denver. And oddly, we had our conversation at Bandamere Speedway at the racetrack. I was waiting to get in. Uh-huh. It was Friday, and it's, you know, race night. And I knew she wanted to talk to me, so I made an exception. I'm usually closed on Fridays because I want to concentrate on my stress relief. And she was telling me the case that they're going to hire me on. And it is phenomenal. Husband and wife, originally from Mexico, became naturalized U.S. Mm-hmm. citizens. They became friends with another Mexican national who's here illegally. And to be, since we're, I don't know whether we're restricted on podcasts, this is not terrestrial radio, so I don't know whether, in an effort to keep this PG rated,
I think we're just trying to do it to be nice versus any kind of FCC requirements.
Yeah. So in any event, let's just put it this way. The three of them had a menage a trois.
Okay.
Or what is the current phrase that they use? They ditched that for a throuple as opposed to a couple. So
I have not heard that before.
Oh, that was
I speak French. So I know menage a trois makes perfect sense to me.
Right. But the throuple came out of that congresswoman from California who was involved in a threesome. And then, if you remember that was the coin. That was the phrase that they coined to describe that relationship. They were a throuple. So long.
I think I may have been too busy with my own case.
Yeah, I would imagine that probably would be the case. But in any event, this is another case that's probably going to, she's shooting for a U visa. And so here we go again. I mean, this is where it gets interesting, and I'm going to segue right into this. The I-360 self-petitions, which are the ones where you marry a U.S. citizen, you never get the paperwork filed, and you file your paperwork on your own claiming that you're the victim of abuse or neglect. I pulled the stats before the show, and the total that is going on right now, in 2019, there were over 11,838 I-360 self-petitions filed. 2018, the year before, 11,216. 2017, 10,485. and the numbers go down, PT.
Further back,
BT, yeah. Prior to Trump. So my belief is, and this is just a hunch, is that the reason why we've seen a spike is because people became desperate because Trump had this hard line on illegal immigration, and these individuals figured, I need a way to stay in the country. Now, the U visas, we are at 266,000 pending.
Whoa.
And then I think the T visas are about 5,000 pending, and they're below the cap. For the T visa,
just a reminder what U versus T for people that are.
But the T are trafficked visas, and they're more difficult to prove, and therefore more difficult to get. The U visa, especially in California, is relatively easy to get the law enforcement support or certification that they're the victim of a crime and they're assisting in the investigation and prosecution. California passed a bill that required all California law enforcement agencies to issue the 918B, which is a law enforcement supplement for a U visa application, regardless of whether there was physical evidence of a crime. If an alien walked in the door and said, I'm the victim of one of the qualifying crimes, I want a 918B, the California legislature and governor said, you got to give it to them. So as a result, we've seen a spike where, like I said, 266,000 cases behind. And as a result, at 10,000 visas per year, which is the maximum number of visas they can issue because that's the cap that Congress put on it, do the math, you're looking at 26.6 years before you even get there. So, you know.
But in the meantime, you can stay.
Right. In the meantime.
And do your thing. And, right. And you're here legally.
Right.
Because you can't be removed.
Correct. You're under deferred action. You have what they call conditional approval. You get your work permit, you get public assistance, you get the whole panoply of whether it's Section 8 housing, SNAP, Medicaid.
That's interesting that you can get all that government assistance, but because I brought my ex in under marriage, he can't get public assistance, or if he does, I have to reimburse the government for it.
Correct.
There's a small segment where I stupidly fell in love and brought someone here who then defrauded me. He can't get public assistance like many other types of statuses will allow.
Mm-hmm.
If he gets it, then I have to reimburse him, or he'll be rejected saying that, but you have someone that can pay for you.
Right.
Like that blows my mind. So, man, don't fall in love. Well, don't fall in love with somebody.
Marry American.
Marry American and get a prenup and make sure the prenup says the other person will pay your fee. I mean,
just so that we spread the wealth a little bit. Okay.
Yes.
False allegations of domestic violence is not limited to immigration based marriages. Okay.
Yes, I'm sure. Yes.
I have a case I'm working on in which both ex-spouses are U.S. citizens. However, there are allegations of domestic violence being made against the U.S. citizen male because the child support situation, which is a little unusual, this individual, this U.S. citizen male, is a drag racer and circle track racer. And he was teaching his now 13-year-old daughter to race. And she's got hooked on it, hook, line, and sinker, lock, stock, and barrel. And the way they negotiated the child support for the divorce was, since he's paying for all the racing, to include the purchasing of the car, the maintenance on the car, the fuel, the oil, the maintenance, you know, travel to and from races throughout the Rocky Mountain region, whether it be Wyoming, whether it be Colorado, whether it be Utah, wherever, and necessitates the purchase of a truck and a trailer, enclosed trailer. He pays $75 a month in child support because he's paying all of the racing fees, which amount to well over $10,000 a year.
A lot. Yeah. That sounds like a lot, yeah.
So this is the way they negotiated it. Well, the ex-wife and her current husband are in a financial bind. And as a result, they're seeking a way in which to tap him for more child support. Well, as long as he's doing the racing, they can't do it. So he's been falsely accused of abusing his 13-year-old daughter. Physically, not sexually, thank God. And now there's an existing protection order that prohibits him from interacting with both his daughter and his ex-wife, so it makes racing impossible. So our belief is what's going to happen is she's going to run into court and say, well, the racing is no longer viable, therefore I need an increase in child support to somewhere between $400 and $500 a month, if not more.
So she doesn't get the offset. Yeah.
Right, correct. So, I mean, this is stuff that goes on in American marriages.
I know. It does. And that's basically why I've just decided not to get married again, actually, U.S. citizen or not.
Okay.
Like, I'm good.
Okay.
I'm not wealthy, but I am a woman who's educated and makes decent money. And so I've realized, like, wow, I just, no matter what, I don't care. Income differential, no, I'm good.
Okay. Like, so.
Stuff happens. But so, I realized. John, I want to, because I realize we're almost up to an hour. Like, we just do this. We get going.
Yep.
The other thing that really struck me that I don't want to lose track of is on that page 34 of the GAO report, where you talk about that the, and see all the acronyms, you get lost in them, but it's like the Fraud Detection National something.
FDNS.
National Security.
Yeah, FDNS.
Directorate, whatever the heck that is.
Right.
But they're supposed to refer petitions that suspect fraud to Homeland Security investigations, but only in these three cases where the alien is subject of a text record, which I'll have you describe in a moment. USCIS suspects misconduct on the part of the self-petitioner's attorney, notary, interpreter, or preparer application, not the self-petitioner themselves. Not anyone that colluded with them. No one that did a false affidavit, nothing. Only for the misconduct on the part of those entities or evidence of a criminal conviction. And again, we've talked before with deportable offenses how hard it is to actually get a criminal conviction.
Right.
They say evidence of a criminal conviction of an offense that is not grounds for inadmissibility or removability is present, among other things.
Right.
So maybe you say, talk about text, but this basically means that there's almost really no or very few reasons FDNS would actually refer suspected fraud for further investigation.
Okay, so let's walk down this road in the time we have left. The FDNS is a acronym, as you said, it's Fraud Detection and National Security. It is a organization within the framework of USCIS. And what people have to understand is USCIS, or U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, is not a law enforcement agency. They have no arrest authority. They have no subpoena authority. They cannot get arrest or search warrants. They cannot refer cases to the U.S. Attorney Criminal Division for criminal prosecution. Everything has to go through ICE, okay? And there's two divisions within ICE dealing with immigration issues. There's Homeland Security Investigations, and then there's Enforcement and Removal Operations. And both of them have criminal enforcement authority, where whether you're talking about ERO, which is Enforcement and Removal Operations, or HSI, which is Homeland Security Investigations, the agents there can go ahead and apply for and get search warrants, arrest warrants, testify at federal grand juries, present cases to the U.S. attorney for acceptance for prosecution, which we're about to get into, and then testify at grand juries and you know, do their criminal investigation, go out and arrest the individual, bring them to the marshals, present them for an advisement before a U.S. district court magistrate judge, and then off to the races they go. So FDNS, you know, they say they conduct investigations. Yeah, they're administrative. They're not criminal. Okay. Mm-hmm. So part of the problem is that there's a training deficiency for USCIS, because before it was USCIS and it was the old INS, adjudicators got virtually the same training as enforcement and removal operations or investigations got, okay, which is 22 weeks at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glinko, Georgia. And it would be a police training course. You would go through firearms, defensive tactics, use of force, the laws of unarrest, search and seizure, constitutional law, all this stuff, in addition to immigration law, immigration procedure, Spanish, the whole nine yards. You would be there for 22 mm-hmm. weeks. Now, a brand new hired adjudicator for USCIS gets a whopping 3 weeks training. So there's a drop off on training. So according to this, when a case gets referred to ICE, and it's a criminal case that needs to go, ICE makes a determination whether or not it fits within their parameters of their enforcement pyramid, okay? Their objectives, I'm having a senior moment. What they consider...
Their criteria.
Yeah, right? Their criteria for what they're going to look at, their priorities. So if it meets their priorities... and they conduct a criminal investigation. They then have to refer it to the United States Attorney's Office, Criminal Division, for acceptance. So an assistant U.S. attorney reviews it and then determines whether or not they're going to accept the case for prosecution or not. If they decline to prosecute, it's over. It's done. We're finished. If they accept it, then they have to impanel a grand jury. The agent goes with all the evidence, presents the case through the U.S. attorney that's prosecuting the case, and then the 23 people sitting on the federal grand jury vote to indict or not to indict. If they indict, then the arrest warrant is issued, the agent goes out and arrests the individual, and they're into the system. So there's...
It is hard for me to imagine that this happens with my case. Like, he's committed fraud, even if it looks super suspicious, mm-hmm. that this actually gets through the system, gets referred by FDNS, gets to ICE or Homeland Security investigations, gets to the point of the grand jury. There's an indictment. Then they actually come here and actually get him. I just don't see that happening. And he has committed fraud against the U.S. government. Well, something I would be terrified of doing.
Right. And the thing is that there's a blanket declination throughout the country by U.S. attorneys throughout the country that they will not routinely, there's always an exception to the rule, but they would not routinely accept a one-on-one marriage fraud case for prosecution. They'll go after the marriage fraud rings, the organizations, the groups that promote this, but they're not going to go after the individual, as in your case. And what they claim is they rely on immigration, whether it be ICE or USCIS, to deal with it administratively through removal proceedings. Put them in removal proceedings, put them before an immigration judge, and hopefully get them deported. Okay. It's a very inefficient system. It's very time consuming. Contrary to the myths and superstitions that are out there, ICE doesn't show up at somebody's doorstep at 6 a.m., drags them kicking and screaming out of the house, puts them in a vehicle, drives them to the airport, puts them on an airplane, and sends them home. It's a very convoluted system in which the alien has a lot of due process rights and protections, and they have a hearing before an immigration judge. And if they're out on bond or personal recognizance, that hearing won't happen for at least a year, if not longer, possibly, now with COVID, probably 2 to 3 years. If they get ordered deported, if they file an appeal with the Board of Immigration Appeals within 30 days, that appeal acts to stay the execution of the removal order, and they get to stay and hang out while all this is going on, and that'll take 3 to 4 to 5 years. And usually what happens is they disappear into the woodwork, and then your fugitive operation teams of enforcement and removal operations have to go hunt these people down, arrest them. And that's when they come in at 6 a.m., pull you out of the house, put you in a vehicle, but they don't drive you to the airport. They drive you to a detention facility where you sit until they can arrange for your removal back to the home country of origin at taxpayer expense.
That's what happened to the that's what happened to the two guys here in my hometown, where I did look up, I found the record of one of the guys, and he like had, I think it was fourth degree assault multiple times, convicted of it, multiple times, again, as a domestic violence dispute. And the other one had like smaller crimes, but this one guy was like many, and we, again, how hard is it to get a conviction? Numerous convictions for a deportable offense. I don't have the details, but the paper said something like he had been asked by immigration to leave voluntarily. I don't know how that goes or if that's accurate. But then they finally did come to actually get him, and people didn't want him to go. And they were very concerned it was a raid. And they're like, no, we're here to pick up two individuals that have criminal records.
Right.
But this is, so this is just how hard it is. Somebody can commit fraud and there's basically no repercussions.
You're right.
I mean, these three reasons that FTNS is even to forward suspected fraud has absolutely nothing to do with the immigrant actually committing fraud themselves.
And, it, you know, this is the state of affairs. And, you know, you and I can keep going. We're over the...
But are we already in an hour again?
We're at an hour, 6 minutes and change.
Okay, we should cut it off.
So we should shut it off. But... You know, for those of you who are listening, your co-hosts, John and Emily, will be back next week. And at that point, I think, I don't know, do you want to start talking about my favorite TV program of all times, 90 Day Fiancé?
Yes, I know, because I need a week to actually watch some more of it, because I'm not fresh. But yes, and then there's all sorts of, the actual political commentary on that. But I want to get refreshed a little bit on the characters. So let's do that next week. That
okay.
Sounds good.
That'll work. So, boys and girls, until next week, I'm John.
And Emily.
And we'll be back. So we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. And tune in next week when we continue with the Violence Against Women Act. In future episodes, as I said last week, we're going to look at and discuss the insanely popular The Learning Channel's or TLC's show, 90 Day Fiancé. We will be taking a look at the saga of Colt Johnson and Larissa Dos Santos Lima and where they are today and how their drama continues. Thanks for listening. We're your hosts, John Sampson and Emily Cortez. See you next week. We'll be right back.